Welcome everyone. Thanks for coming. The video you just watched is by a group called Musaddin. They're a nonprofit media collective born out of the explosion of citizen journalism and cultural activism in Egypt after the revolution. This event has been organized by the Global Justice Working Group of Occupy Wall Street. And tonight we'll be talking about the weapons of repression, with a focus on tear gas made in the U.S. and used against people all over the world, including people here in the U.S. With the anniversary of the Egyptian Revolution fast approaching, we'll be hearing tonight from activist and professor Samah Salim about the use of U.S.-made tear gas against nonviolent protesters in Egypt, and from Maya Ramnath with Adela New York about U.S. support for the manufacture, sale, and purchase of tear gas by the governments of multiple countries. My name is Lydia Kendil. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition to Defend the Egyptian Revolution, which is a coalition in support of the Egyptian Revolution, which started last year in November upon the call for solidarity from Egyptian activists. And I just wanted to read to you a small part of the letter that was written by Egyptian activists to solidarity activists here in the U.S. Our strength is in our shared struggle. If they stifle our resistance, the 1% will win. In Cairo, New York, London, Rome, everywhere. But while the revolution lives, our imaginations know no bounds. We can still create a world worth living. You can help us defend our revolution. And so the G8, IMF, and Gulf states are promising the regime loans of $35 billion. The U.S. gives the Egyptian military $1.3 billion annually in aid, as we all know. And governments all over the world continue their long-term support and alliance with the military rulers of Egypt. The bullets they kill us with are made in America. The tear gas that burns from Oakland to Palestine is made in Wyoming. David Cameron's first visit to post-revolutionary Egypt was to close an arms deal. People's lives, freedoms, and futures must stop being trafficked for strategic assets. We must unite against governments who do not share their people's interests. We're calling on you to undertake solidarity actions to help us oppose this crackdown. And so I'd like to introduce Professor Rick Samahsali.
Thanks, Hadir. That video, you know, every time I see it, it always gives me goosebumps. It's incredible. I've watched it like 20 times. Amazing work that Musaddin has been doing, and their sister campaign, Kezibun, Askar Kezibun, which means liars in English, to sort of publicize what the SCAF has been doing. On Egypt streets, you know, over the last 6 months or so, I'm really happy to be here. I'm really glad to have been invited to this event, and I really want to thank the Global Justice Working Group at Occupy Wall Street and the War Resisters League and Adela for all the wonderful work that they've been doing, especially on this tear gas campaign. And what I want to talk about a little bit today is this whole question of solidarity that Hadir just raised right now, which is what this event is all about, as a kind of lead up to the first anniversary of the Egyptian Revolution on January 25th. So, solidarity, right? So, you know, the acts of solidarity in the end are really the lifeblood of any revolution. The kinds of acts that are performed by events like these and others. And, you know, the thing that SCAF in Egypt is most terrified by is these kinds of acts of solidarity. For example, the whole campaign of criminalization of activists that's going on right now in Egypt is about criminalizing and demonizing or foreclosing the possibility of enacting solidarity, right? So a few months ago, the accusations against April 6th that were made, that they were, you know, receiving training from OTPOR, the Serbian youth movement that toppled Slobodan Milosevic, the most recent NGO raids that happened in Egypt, I'm sure you all heard about them. The whole discourse about foreign agendas, right? I mean, what is that about in the end? It's about preventing people, making them afraid of reaching out across territorial borders, but also reaching out within, you know, within their own national spaces, right? So solidarity is something that happens across borders, but it's also something that happens, you know, in a particular place, such as Tahrir Square, for example, right? So this sort of campaign or criminalization of the possibility of solidarity is sort of like, I mean, I was thinking about this today, it's sort of like a mirror image of what here in the United States we have now in the form of laws against what they call material support of terrorism, right? It's kind of the same thing, it works both ways. Sorry, I can't see here. So why is this, right? What is the whole issue about tear gas in particular, and this is what we're here to talk about today, why is tear gas so particularly evil, if you will, or horrible as a weapon against, you know, democratic protest movements? It's not just that tear gas, and I would argue that tear gas is actually even worse than live ammunition, right? With a gun, you target individuals, right? You first, you know, have to go from one person to the next. But with tear gas, you're not just targeting individual human bodies, right? You're actually targeting the body of the revolution. Because what is it about a revolution? A revolution absolutely depends on people coming together in open public spaces to perform these acts of solidarity that I was talking about a little while ago. And so the tear gas is really a way of wounding the body of the revolution, dispersing people, preventing them from coming together. And this was something that the Mubarak regime was very, very good at. You know, for 30 years, the Mubarak regime created a situation where public space was either privatized and sort of reserved for wealthy elites, or destroyed, right? So that people weren't able to sort of go out on the street and use public space in ways that were empowering. And that's what the revolution changed, right? That's what the revolution in Egypt changed forever. For the first time in 30 years, people from all walks of life, all classes, you know, men and women and all age groups came out and sort of performed this act of being together in a way that had never been possible before. And this was really a magical kind of situation, right? So, and Tahrir Square was the symbol of this, obviously. I mean, this kind of coming together was happening on the street and squares all over the country. But Tahrir Square is a very symbolic place. And I just want to say that, you know, it's interesting that the translation, the English translation of the Arabic word maydan, is actually a really sad translation, because the Arabic word is so much more powerful and polyvalent than square, right? The Arabic word actually refers to an arena. An arena that's also a battlefield, right? So a maydan is where a battle is staged in a war. And this is definitely one of the aspects of what the maydan in Tahrir was all about. A maydan can also be a playground, and this is also very much one of the aspects of what Tahrir Square was all about in the revolution, right? People coming together to fight, but also to sort of engage in acts of, you know, solidarity that become artworks, right, through the act of coming together and sort of fighting this revolution together, right? Anyway, I want to show a very short film right now about the Battle of Muhammad Mahmud, because this is where, obviously, it was this one-week battle where the largest amounts of tear gas were used, and it was estimated that at the most intense moments of fighting, up to 6 canisters of gas were fired per minute, right? So that's like a really incredibly huge amount of tear gas. It was also Muhammad Mahmud, which, you know, this Battle of Muhammad Mahmud, which began on November 19th and lasted till November 24th, was the first time, really, since the occupation of July, the occupation of Tahrir Square that began on July 8th, that the square sort of came to life again in the same, you know, incredibly powerful way that it had done during that month-long occupation in July. Live ammunition was, of course, used, but again, it was the tear gas that really marked this battle as the kind of unique battle that it was. And interestingly, in the battle that happened afterwards at the cabinet building, no tear gas was used, right? So it seems to me pretty clear that the international pressure that was brought to bear on SCAF because of this really, vicious and indiscriminate use of tear gas did have some effects. You know, they threw everything in the cabinet building battle in Asulaini Street. They threw everything at the protesters, literally, including the kitchen cabinets and the kitchen sink from the windows, but they didn't dare fire a single canister of tear gas, which was really interesting. So I'd like to screen the film now. I just want you to pay a little bit of attention to both the beginning and the end of the film. The beginning of the film, you'll see some of the fighters, the revolutionaries, or what we call the soldiers of the revolution, right, yelling out this phrase in Arabic, isbat, isbat, which means stand your ground, right? And I'll talk about that in a second after the film. And then at the end, the chant goes up, Mishanimshi, Howeyimshi, which was a chant that was used during the 18 days in January of 2011, which means we're not leaving, he's got to leave. In January of 2011, this was a reference to Mubarak. On November 23rd, which is when this film was shot, in Muhammad Mahmoud, it's obviously a reference to the SCAF, right? So if we could just screen the film now, that would be great.
Thank you.
going on literally night and day for 7 days, which is really an incredible thing when you think about it. You know, people were getting wounded, people were getting killed, and being, you know, taken outside of the street by the motorcycle ambulance brigades. I'm sure, you know, many of you heard about these sort of a volunteer corps of kids with motorcycles from the surrounding popular neighborhoods who would come and sort of park and wait to be able to go in and bring people out. Now, I just want to mention that this was going on in Muhammad Mahmoud. Meanwhile, in Tahrir Square itself, the square was full. There were tens of thousands of people in the square, right? The people in the square were not actively fighting, but they had a very important role. So they had the role of providing reserve troops, right? People would fall in Muhammad Mahmoud Street, more would go in to take their place from the square. The field clinics were there. You know, people, the vendors were there, tea and food, and people were drinking tea and, you know, sort of, the atmosphere in Tahrir Square itself was so different from Muhammad Mahmoud, but as a friend of mine, you know, remarked to me at one point, we are the guardians of the battle that's going on in Muhammad Mahmoud right now. We are the ones who guarantee their well-being and their eventual victory just by being physically here in the square. And that's what it was really like, right? Now, I just want to mention that, you know, there was a lot of talk about the tear gas and how suddenly, you know, the SCAF decided that they were going to be using a different kind of tear gas. On Tuesday night, the night before this film was shot, in fact, it was the day after a million-man demonstration in the square. The square was jam-packed. Suddenly, people started to, you know, fall down on the ground in the middle of the square and go into convulsions. Nobody knew what was going on. It was utter panic. And we walked into one of these sort of pockets of what everybody suspects was CR gas, right? The normal gas is the CR SCS gas that they had been using all along, which is horrible. The CR gas was, you know, a completely a different story. As many of you have probably seen, it induced convulsions, seizures, death. Many people died from it, right? But the worst part about it was the blindness and the panic. In less than half an hour, that invisible CR gas that they were using succeeded in emptying half of the square. I mean, it was incredible. And this is what I mean by the way in which why the tear gas is really the most effective weapon against the revolution, the living body of the revolution. People left the square, and this was a major victory, right? This was exactly what it was intended to do. And the funny thing is that, you know, I mean, you know, people, everybody has been talking about the resilience of the Egyptian revolutionaries and the way in which they're constantly improvising sort of antidotes to the gas, you know, the improvised helmets and so forth and so on. You know, the really funny sort of joke that came out in the wake of the CR gas was the chant, the people want the old gas back, right? Which was based on the rhyme of the people want the fall of the regime. So I don't have much more time to speak, but I just want to say that, you know, this idea of stand your ground, one of the most terrifying things about being in the square during this battle was that suddenly, for no obvious reason, you would be standing there and you would see 2,000 people suddenly running away from the mouth of the street because of the tear gas, right? A stampede, like a human tidal wave of people running away. And then the chant would immediately go up. Isbeth, Isbeth, stand your ground, stand your ground. And, you know, you're standing there and you see this tidal wave coming at you and your feeling is utter panic, right? And like magic, when the chant goes up, stand your ground, people stood their ground and stopped. And that feeling, the feeling of witnessing something like that, I don't have words to describe how incredibly powerful it was. Sort of talismanic almost, right? So I just want to say that, you know, I had this little anecdote which I just have to tell you because the first day of classes I teach at Rutgers University was just a couple of days ago, and I was walking by this construction site on campus and I saw this really bizarre sign that said, "Nothing is more important than safety. If it's not safe, please don't do it." Right? So I just want to say that, you know, it's words like these that are the slogan of the counter-revolution, which is a global counter-revolution, right? It's not just going on in Egypt. as we've seen through, you know, the attacks on demonstrators, you know, all over from New York City and Occupy Wall Street to Athens, the Parliament building, and now in Cairo, obviously, right? So I would like to say that they are the ones who use the violence, and we are the ones who stand our ground. So many people in Tahrir have said to me and keep saying that much more blood is coming, right? And that it's a price that they are gladly willing to pay for their freedom. So that's why in Egypt we honor the dead as martyrs. That's why we call them martyrs, right? So don't be safe. Don't be afraid and stand your ground. Asoda Mustamira, long live the revolution. Thank you.
Please welcome Tamar, a videographer based in New York City.
Hey everyone, sorry. So this is just like a 2-3 minute video trying to show a little bit, contrasting a little bit of where tear gas has been used most recently, between Oakland, which everybody here is familiar with, to all over the Arab world and how it's used as a tool. And not to minimize in any way the way that it's being used differently in all of these areas, but just kind of draw a little bit of the similarities as well. So come play. In the Oakland videos, you saw two different ones, which was one of Scott Olson, which was the Marine, and Scott Campbell. And Scott Campbell, he was filming that kept cutting back and forth, and he's just filming the police, is this okay, is this okay? And then he gets shot, and he's like very shocked that he got shot. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, in doing some of this research and talking with people, actually yesterday with a journalist from Ethiopia and asking him, you know, where are the most recent places in Africa that tear gas is being used? Can you get me photos and what kinds and things like that? And he was saying, telling to me how much, you know, actually they prefer tear gas still because it's still for them, it's not live bullets, you know? And then here, you know, our perception being, well, it's still tear gas, and then being shot at, you know, having somebody say that on camera, being like, you shot me, like, and how shocking that is for somebody to be shot with a tear gas canister. But then in Palestine and in many other countries where that is the reality of a weekly basis of tear gas being lethal, and the hundreds of people that have lost their lives, many American, you know, we can talk about, there was a girl, Emily, I don't know how to say her last name. How is it?
Hanakowitz.
You know, she was an artist that was shot in the eye and lost her eye as a result of, you know, American tear gas canisters, and there's many, many more. And, you know, hopefully this is a continuing project and trying to draw all those connections between all the people that have lost their lives and then holding, you know, what is our role here as people right now residing in the United States and holding the companies that are selling to all these regimes accountable. So we're going to get into that next.
Images that we're becoming very used to, unfortunately. Next up is Maya Ramnath, a teacher and writer and activist who is part of the Global Justice Working Group and Adat in New York, who will be talking about how the U.S. companies profit off of weapons sales and tear gas sales to Egypt's staff.
So yeah, and I just want to emphasize too that while I'm the person doing the talking tonight, this presentation really is a very collective effort. And Allison and Udi, who are both out in the house, did a lot of the research for this. Ethan and Greg, who are also out here, did the artwork, or the visuals, and also a comic, which gives a lot of the same information in a really distributable form, which is out there. So check that out at the end. So one of the major aims of the Global Justice Working Group has been to try to forge connections between the popular movements that are part of this upsurge of grassroots democracy in many different parts of the world. And ironically, one of the biggest clues to seeing these uprisings as interconnected is by tracking the repression of these uprisings and seeing how that's interconnected. So as we've seen in the previous presentations, in other words, look for the counter-revolution, and we can see how the counter-revolution is a transnational effort, and that helps us to see the different sites of the revolution as interconnected. So what do we know? We know that tear gas canisters manufactured by companies in the United States have been used in repressing popular movements, not only in this country, but in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Palestine, in Yemen, in Tunisia, and we suspect in many other parts of the world as well, where there's been significant protest activity lately, such as Nigeria, Chile, Argentina, and a lot of different places in the world. We don't have solid information on all of this. We haven't done the trail of how tear gas and money are getting where. Partly we don't have time to go into all that much of that anyways tonight, but I also wanted to just mention that because part of the point is that the difficulty in compiling clear information is part of the point. This non-transparency is exactly part of the point. It's not an accident. So we know that these corporations are profiting from the repression of democracy in this country and throughout the world. We also know that the U.S. government is very aware of and promotes these sales, in many cases is directly involved with these sales. So while it's clear that there is deep collusion, deep moral complicity between government policy and corporate profit, it's not always so evident how that actually works, what the process is by which that actually works. So what we want to talk about tonight, we're talking about one specific aspect of this relationship. So this is one specific aspect of the role of the U.S. military-industrial complex in repressing democracy. But But I think it's important to remember that we're talking about specifics. We're talking about tear gas. We're focused on the Middle East. We're focused on the United States right now. But this is one instance of a much, much bigger phenomenon. So we're talking about a lot of other products, other quote-unquote non-lethal products. Stun grenades, like a lot of different technologies are part of this. A lot of different countries are part of this. And this is part of a very long history as well. It's not just, this didn't all start in 2011. This is part, I mean, there's a long history of militarized policing, of globalized resistance to an imperial world order, a neoliberal world order. So just to keep all that in mind, that the context, we have to focus in because there's a lot of information, but to always keep aware of this context is always so huge. So what I want to do first, I want to start out by just giving a little overview of some of the main tear gas manufacturing companies that are involved in this. Are you guys ready with the, all right. So several of the same companies' products have been documented in many of the recent protest zones, and you've seen the visuals of some of those. So the first one that we're going to talk about is called Defense Technologies. This is headquartered in Casper, Wyoming. And along with another U.S. company called Federal Laboratories, they share a product line, and they're owned by a UK-based company called BAE Systems. So Defense Technology and or Federal Laboratories tear gas has been used in Oakland, Palestine, Egypt, Bahrain, Tunisia, and Yemen. So the Yemeni government is documented to have regularly been using tear gas from those companies against pro-democracy protesters demonstrating since February. So, and the reason we can tell is because we can see their brand name. There are photographs and videos of, you can see the brand name stamped on the canisters in the footage of post-protest wreckage. In Palestine, Defense Technologies provides tear gas to the Israeli police, and its canisters have been found in East Jerusalem. Previously, Federal Laboratories provided tear gas to Israel during the first Intifada and was the subject of the object of quite a few protests and lawsuits during that period, so going all the way back to the 80s. It's interesting that a lot of these, this Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, a lot of different sort of NGOs were calling them on the dangerous and or lethal use of tear gas at that time, but a lot of this sort of discussion around that has had to do with the misuse of tear gas. Like, oh, you fired it at people's heads. Oh, you fired it at children. Oh, you fired it in enclosed spaces. So we're gonna stop delivering it until you start using it correctly. We want to emphasize that there is no correct use of tear gas. So it's not enough to be like, oh no, shoot low. Don't shoot at someone's head. Okay, then it's okay. It's not okay. So it's just interesting. I think you can see this sort of evolution in how the criticism of the use of tear gas is developing as well. We talked a little bit about Oakland. You've all heard about Scott Olson. That was Defense Technology tear gas, as far as we know. And police also fired that tear gas directly onto the people who came to his aid. So the second company that's been significant in this is Non-Lethal Technologies. This is actually the name of the company. Non-Lethal Technologies. Based in Homer City, Pennsylvania, Non-Lethal Technologies is the primary provider of tear gas to the government of Bahrain, which has been brutally repressing peaceful mass protests since February and March. So these protests are still continuing almost every day, according to interviews with Bahraini activists, although protesters have been jailed, tortured, killed, fired from work, expelled from school. They're still going out and going out and going out. And one more recent example, actually this was in August, but a documented death that we have here is in Sitra. 14-year-old Ali al-Sheikh was killed when police fired a tear gas canister at close range into the back of his neck, killing him almost instantly. And Non-Lethal Technologies canisters have been seen littered across the ground after pretty much all of these pro-democracy demonstrations in Sitra. The last company, and this is maybe the biggest one we're going to talk about tonight, is called CSI, and this is one we've been hearing about a lot lately. CSI is headquartered in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, and that stands for Combined Systems Incorporated. They manufacture products under the brand name of Combined Tactical Systems, or CTS, so that's kind of the way we track them, as you see CTS stamped on the tear gas canisters. They've been supplying Tunisia, Yemen, Germany, Netherlands, India, East Timor, Hong Kong, Argentina, Thailand, Trinidad and Tobago, Cameroon, Chile and Sierra Leone, as well as, to our knowledge, there may be others, as well as the most high-profile clients lately are Egypt and Israel. So CSI is owned by Point Lookout Capital and the Carlyle Group, with Point Lookout Capital owning the controlling shares. FYI, they are located right here in New York City. We'll get to that again later, too. So, and I want to give you this quote from Point Lookout Portfolio page on their website. They have a section on, they own the controlling shares in the company, so this is part of their portfolio. And their section on CSI reads, "The company's CTS-branded product line is the premier less lethal line in the industry today." So notice they don't say non-lethal, they say it's less lethal than bullets, and it's the premier product. So CSI is the primary supplier of tear gas to the Israeli military, as well as to the Israeli police and border police. There's a lot of written documentation of their sales and shipments there, and CTS canisters are pretty much ubiquitous at Palestinian protests, including the recurrent nonviolent demonstrations at Bilin, Nilin, and Nabi Saleh. So some recent specific cases of less lethal, pretty lethal, uses of that tear gas there. So you may have heard of Mustafa Tamimi, who died in December from Nabi Saleh. On December 9th, an Israeli soldier in an armored jeep fired a tear gas canister at close range directly into his face. Before that, actually about a year ago, in January 2011, Jawahar Abu Rahma of Bilin was overcome with tear gas inhalation after having attended a protest the previous day. And her brother, Bassem Abu Rahma, died in April 2009 when an Israeli soldier fired a tear gas canister directly into his chest. And aside from these deaths documented, there's been countless injuries. The Popular Struggle Coordination Committee, which is a coordinating body for the unarmed demonstrations in the West Bank, noted in a 2010 report that the Palestinian Red Crescent records reported 18 people directly shot and hit by high-velocity projectiles since their introduction, only in the two villages of Bilin and Nilin, and we don't have accurate documentation of how representative that is, but those are for sure. So in the more recent Arab Spring associated uprisings, photos and news reports have shown that CSI is the major tear gas provider for Tunisia, and documented deaths there include a Tunisian protester and a French photographer killed from tear gas fired at close range. CSI is the primary tear gas used by the Egyptian security forces in its attempt to crush demonstrations there, ongoing. In all the coverage, as you've seen some of it, the copious, thick tear gas is everywhere to be seen, and the CTS canisters are also everywhere to be seen. Most recently, Amnesty International documented 3 shipments of tear gas from CSI from the U.S. to Egypt in 2011, approved by the U.S. State Department, although this was after it had come out that the Egyptian security forces were on record of using tear gas to kill and injure protesters. So there's a lot more information in those kinds of reports. In the interest of time, I'm gonna skip over a lot of the detail there, but this is all out there. This is information that can be found. In November protests, which we saw in the recent film, tear gas was fired repeatedly, often into enclosed spaces such as field hospitals, churches, and mosques, where there's people, many of whom were probably already injured from the demonstrations, in a vulnerable place close together. And again, canisters are fired directly at protesters, and at least 4 people are known to have died from tear gas asphyxiation. So, I mean, we could go on all night recording tear gas presence and atrocities in all these places, but I want to talk a little bit more now about how does the tear gas get from manufacturers in the United States to these various governments overseas? So I kind of see it as a sort of triangular relationship between the US government, the US corporations, and governments of other countries. So those 3 points of that relationship are always present, but the movement of the stuff from here to there goes by different pathways and different mechanisms. And one thing to emphasize here in this is the complicity between the state and corporate interests. So we have the war profiteers. We have government policies that are actively working in their favor. So even when it's a commercial sale, I'll talk about this later, but so even when it's simply a commercial sale, tear gas, like any other weapon, is subject to export controls. So at the very least, U.S.-made tear gas can't be shipped abroad without government approval. So in best-case scenario, they're simply saying, yeah, it's okay, send it over there. In the most direct involvement, they're actually the people bringing it there with taxpayer money. So here are some of the ways that, this process happens. So the first way is through foreign military sales, as it's called. So foreign military sales are government-to-government transactions which are administered by a Pentagon agency called the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. And in the case of foreign military sales, the requests are initiated by the purchasing country, and then they're handled by the U.S. Embassy in that country. And then the Pentagon sort of makes the whole transaction happen, although the State Department also has the power to approve, reject, or halt any purchase. So where do the items come from that, are being given in this transaction? They're either coming from existing Pentagon stocks or new production, in which case the Defense Department contracts with a U.S. arms manufacturer to build the weapons. Say, we're selling some weapons to these people over here. Will you make this for us? In some cases, they provide related services and take care of the paperwork. So the three top buyers for fiscal year 2010, and that's the last year that we have these numbers for, were Egypt, Israel, and Kuwait. So Egypt is on record for $2.45 billion worth of foreign military sales in 2010, Israel for $3.95 billion, and Kuwait for $1.6 billion. So the second way is direct commercial sales. And with direct commercial sales, the purchases are negotiated directly between the client country and the manufacturer. So in this case, the U.S. government is a little more of a background role. They simply approve the purchases. So the commercial route, the direct commercial sales route, is quicker, maybe cheaper, and has a lot less government oversight than the foreign military sales. So ironically, there seems to be less transparency with the direct commercial sale than with the foreign military sale, because we have such minimal information about what's going on in the sale, about price, about quantity, and because this is classified as confidential business information. So not only does the public not get to see that, Congress often doesn't see that, the press doesn't often see that, so it's difficult to know exactly how much and what is being transferred through direct commercial sales. So the top, again, it's the same countries, though, for which we have the documented numbers of the three top recipients for direct commercial sales. Here we have numbers only from 2009, which are solid numbers. So again, Egypt received $458,000 worth of tear gas and other riot control agents through direct commercial sales. Israel, $1.05 million worth of tear gas and other riot control agents. We don't know how much of that is tear gas and how much is other things, and Kuwait, $1.24 million. So the third way is a little bit different. This is foreign military financing. So this isn't really a sale. This is a case of American taxpayers directly financing foreign governments' purchases of U.S. military products. So this is military aid in the form of grants and loans that are made to foreign governments so that they can purchase U.S.-made military products. So in most cases, the financing is available. You have to use it to purchase products in the United States. And it's not actually a cash grant loan. It's in effect a taxpayer finance subsidy of the military-industrial complex in the form of shipments of military goods and services. So there are some exceptions to this. Often it's stipulated they have to use U.S. products. In some cases, notably in Israel, they're allowed to use a certain percentage of it to buy domestic products. Foreign military financing is regularly applied to the foreign military sales purchases. So this is where it all gets confusing, that you have this triangular relationship, and they're always all there, but there's a lot of very complex, and again, there's links in the chain that we just simply can't find because they're classified, or they're obscured. So it's hard to accurately associate, and because of the even greater lack of transparency with direct commercial sales purchases, it's even harder to know if there are foreign military financing funds associated with those purchases. 5 minutes? Okay, I'm winding down here. So Yeah, just one other note on that. So a note on the role of taxpayer money in supplying tear gas to foreign governments. So we don't always know when we're talking about foreign military financing, we can't say this much was used to buy tear gas, this much was used to buy this or that. But we can say that it contributes, the foreign military financing puts a chunk into the client country's military budget. So even if this particular bit of money didn't buy tear gas, maybe they use that for fighter jets, maybe they use it for tanks or other things, but it frees up the funds for them so that they can then purchase other weapons and tear gas by these other methods. So there's a lot of transferability between the different ways that use value and exchange value of these military products gets there. So the third part of what I was going to talk about today, and sort of winding towards the later part of this event as a whole, is what can be done and what's already been done. So there's a lot of possible things that we can do to act in solidarity based on our site here. We do have proximity to the companies that make this stuff, to the investors that make it possible to make this stuff. I think that's one thing we can do here to help over there. But I'm going to leave all that to you to talk about in discussion. I want to just mention a couple of important examples of what's already been going on recently to protest or intervene in this kind of repression. So on November 26th, 7 tons of CSI musicians arrived at the port of Suez, at the Bia port in Suez. And this was the first of a three-part shipment, which was supposed to total 21 tons of CSI munitions from the United States to Egypt. Customs officials there, the people working at the dock, tried to prevent the entry by refusing to complete the paperwork. So that's another thing to think of. Where can you intervene in the flow of materials and the flow of cash? In the US, there have been 3 protests lately at Point Lookout Capital, including a die-in organized by the OWS Direct Action Working Group and also the Ad Hoc Coalition to Defend the Egyptian Revolution. And Adela, so you can get information on all of those here. There's also been 2 recent protests at CSI in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, one in December 11th, and one just this past week on Martin Luther King Day. And I want to give you one quote from that. This is from a blog post from someone who was involved with that and it's posted on Electronic Intifada. CSI's security director added that the company's CEO and other officials were unavailable as they were to attend the shooting, hunting, outdoor trade show in Las Vegas that week. But I hope that they received the message in some form. And by way of conclusion, I just want to really briefly note that around the world, people are standing up for political freedom, social, and economic justice. Like, you already know that. You're some of those people, too. And you also know that more or less the same people are benefiting, these war profiteers are benefiting from the repression of protest as who benefited from the conditions that sparked the protest in the first place. So we have transnational collusion in military policing, militarized policing. But what's most illuminating in all of this to me is what this kind of intervention indicates about where the threat to the regime is seen to come from. So it's not like all of this, we're not talking anymore about states, external enemies, we're not even talking about terrorist groups. The threat to the global order, the threat to the stability of the regimes that everyone seems so keen to control is internal, is people, is grassroots democracy, is people saying, no, this system is unacceptable and we don't want it anymore. And that is exciting because that's in all our power. Thanks.
So now to kind of make a connection between the repression that we've been seeing abroad and the police violence here at home, I'd like to welcome Jamal Mims from Stop, Stop and Frisk campaign with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which is a campaign that aims at stopping the NYPD policy of Stop and Frisk. And this was launched in October of last year and is connected to a network of similar campaigns around the U.S.
First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for being here and everyone that presented. present before me. It was really amazing presentations about the connections between, you know, all across global imperialism and the connections between the weapons of oppression. And this is really, quite a central topic when we're dealing with, the scourge of mass incarceration. So I guess I'll begin with what the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is and how we got, how we began and how it all came together. So one summer in July, on a hot summer in July, there was a meeting between a group of people, different activists, as well as different intellectuals, professors, Cornell West, Carl Dixon, attendance, and they meant to strategize in order to come up with a way to bring the fight against mass incarceration to the next level. What was the key kind of missing ingredient that we were seeing? And when we look at this thing of why wasn't there mass resistance, and there was this element of mass resistance that was truly missing from the equation as far as resisting what is on the surface, mass incarceration, the grabbing up and putting into the system of vast amounts of Black and Latino youth. So it was just really to bring the entire fight into the open. And Cornell, kind of with an elbow up, kind of leans over and says, do you think civil disobedience has to be involved? And then Connell kind of gives him a look and then just says, yeah, it definitely does, it really has to be. And then, so that's the kind of other point I wanted to really bring into focus. It was that, we can't kind of step around these weapons of oppression or these weapons of the state, and in fact, the agents of the state. When we're serious about changing the world, when we're serious about challenging the oppression of peoples, that's something that we actually have to think about and actually confront. And so it was on that basis that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network was formed, and kind of there was a call drafted there to call for a day of civil disobedience to stand up against, especially stop and frisk. Seeing stop and frisk as kind of the festering sore on what is a, thoroughly decrepit system of mass incarceration, 2.4 million people locked away in cages, oftentimes for nothing more than a minor drug offense. It was really to take the fight against that entire system, both legally, on the streets, through civil disobedience actions, and in an ongoing way, engendering a nature of mass resistance as a crucial missing element that was missing from the equation so far. What you're really fighting against stop and frisk, and people I'm sure are familiar with Terry versus Ohio and the kind of ruling in 67, and you're dealing with a system where any police officer can throw away your Fourth Amendment rights from and protection against illegal search and seizure simply because what is no longer probable cause, but now just reasonable suspicion and just any kind of inkling. And the categorical implications of this, they span the board. It can be, suspect was wearing clothes commonly committed in a crime. Suspect was, there's on the 250 form, there are literally check boxes for this. Suspect was wearing clothing that was or maybe it was in the season of a crime, perhaps a criminal season or a time of day. Was perhaps he was working too hard to follow the law. That's also another indicator of things. So he's like working a little too hard to drive correctly, then maybe there's something up with him. So these things span the board. And so really what you're looking at, people say, why is this going on? Why do we have a system that can draft up massive amount of people into the system of mass incarceration? There of course are people making money out of it. This is capitalism, people are gonna make money off of that. And of course there are people making, vast amount of sums off of it. But what's the real nature kind of uncovering behind the system? And it's not unprecedented in American society. We've seen these things before. And Michelle Alexander kind of outlines in her book, The New Jim Crow, the you know, you've seen the birth and the death of the slavery system and the rebirth of society along those racial lines after Reconstruction and redemption. And then you have the division again into the Jim Crow system. And then we see the fall of the Jim Crow system with the you know, so-called civil rights movement and advancing beyond that. But right, you know, just as coded in the language of the fall of slavery was the seeds of Jim Crow, within the fall of the Jim Crow era and the rise of, and the gains of civil liberties was coded right into it the system of mass incarceration that we're dealing with today. And so you're talking about overtly coded language, you know, guys like Nixon and the war on drugs that precedes any, you know, drugs were on the decline until the war on drugs, that precedes any, you know, any kind of drug problems. You asked Americans in the 60s, what are the biggest social issues? Drugs was not at the top of the list. And suddenly, there's this, you know, introduction of crack cocaine into impoverished communities, this targeting of Black and Latino so would-be drug traffickers. And now you're looking at a system that has, you know, has risen exponentially along that trajectory, especially under the Clinton administration. And now we're looking at a system with 2.4 million people inside of it, you know, 90% of them. And a full 90% of drug offenses being Black and Latino individuals. And so that's kind of a macro sociological perspective of what, you know, the South Mass Incarceration Network is up against, and Stop and Frisk being the entry point into all of that. You know, you're talking about that happening in New York City 2,000 times a day. You know, you're talking 600,000 times per year. The New York City passed, tipped over 600,000 this year, in fact. 85% of the people were stopped at Black and Latino, 90% of them not doing anything wrong, as in they're not charged with anything. You know, so you're dealing with a system that is deliberately targeting these sections of people. And again, what are the reasons behind this, the political implications behind this? And we have to link it to this issue of global struggle and this thing of, and also this notion of the counterinsurgency before the insurgency, right? You're looking at, from the experience of the 60s and the turbulence, you know, the system kind of got rocked back on its heels. And you have where the kind of the orchestrators and the leaders of that system could kind of see very plainly that they're within the, you know, within the black and Latino youth, within these the margins of society, are where street level organizations like the Panthers and where they actually have the seeds of, you know, of really undoing, of really uniting on both sides, similar to how the populists would, you know, sought to unite both black and white, poor, working class people to actually achieve economic and achieve a vision of equality. The seeds of that kind of undoing were still were fermenting in there. So, you know, and this is also a political gain to gain, you know, white swing voters who had defected from the Democratic Party. Again, a little too lengthy. But, you know, what we're dealing with is straight up and down a slow genocide, a condition that generations and generations and generations have to face. And a lesson that we've drawn from, you know, we call ourselves the new freedom fighters and the new freedom riders of this era. And that's really how we have to see it. We have to be about getting rid of that entire system and stopping first being the first stop in that. And that necessarily entails global solidarity. That necessarily entails it. If we go back to the old Jim Crow and how that was met and defeated and what it took, you know, it not only took, you know, the courageous actions of a certain few to challenge others' humanities, to put something on the line, to really make people, to confront people with this luminous, this kind of very, you know, overbearing just system. But it also necessitated people on the outside of the world, joining in solidarity with that. You know, that was a huge, huge push in the first, you know, in the civil rights movement, and kind of tipping things over. Yeah. Okay, cool. So yeah, I mean, it's so stop and frisk can really be addressed, and when we're talking about these weapons of oppression, and how do we see all these different volumes and multitudes of weapons of destruction, sound cannons, freaking, you know, George Lucas couldn't dream this some of this shit up sometimes, you know. It's why do we see these, you know, these various levels of weapons and things like that? Because you have a system now of mass incarceration that is extremely profitable, where it has a multitude of weapons like that. And it's driven towards the same directives. Whereas there was the tear gas in an overt manner when people start to rise up and are in the streets, there is the consistent and persistent subversion and assault against Black and Latino communities so that they do not rise up. So it's, you know, but this is, but again, and we're talking about linking this again, this is all part of, you know, this is all part of the same system that has to be met and defeated. And we have to face that on kind of clear terms with global solidarity. So, yeah, I just wanted to, one other point that was just really worth noting was kind of this, you know, just drawing comparisons again between where tear gas is used here, or, you know, where tear gas is used here in the United States, and kind of where we see the kind of gross foot of police repression, the grossest feats of police repression. And similarly, during the civil rights movement in the 60s, you had, you know, guys like Nixon coming out about the language, you know, starting to have this coded language about the language of lawlessness. And you're talking about civil disobedience to your own citizens who are choosing to disobey laws because the laws that they're in themselves are unjust. Having that be portrayed and viewed as something that is, that you have to point a gun at and shoot, that you have to stamp out, that is, you know, that is reckless, that's without law and order. And this type of coded language is always, you know, was deliberately had a racial component to it, at least during the Nixon administration, deliberately had a racial component to it. And we see the same sorts of things today when we're drawing lines not only along color and ethnic lines, but across, you know, across communities of all people, and especially people that are targeted today. You know, and it's no coincidence with things like NDAA and, you know, the obscure profiling of not only Black and Latino youth, but Muslims and people of Arab descent, and the extreme profiling that goes on. This is all linked in kind of the same struggle. These are all the same kinds of tools, strategies, and often weapons of repression. So I got buttons, y'all, in the back, stop and frisk buttons, and we have an action coming up January 27th, so I encourage you guys to come out. It'll be in the Bronx. I encourage you guys to come out, and you can find information for it in the back, so you guys can come out, stand in solidarity, act in, stand with us in civil disobedience as we shut down another police precinct that's conducting these unlawful, illegal, unconstitutional.
Thanks so much, Jamel. So speaking of things that are coming up, we're going to have a chance to kind of close with that and all the upcoming things this week and in the future. But I just wanted, before finishing, if maybe people could talk to one another. There's been a lot of listening, so thanks for that. But wanted maybe to kind of break out into small groups. These aren't quite the chairs for it, but maybe just for the next 10 minutes, we could focus on two questions with your neighbors and then share them briefly. And two of those are, you know, I mean, kind of in reacting to this information we've heard and these many conversations. So how has militarized police affected you personally or your community or a community you're connected to? And then second is this connection that people have been alluding to a lot, which is, you know, what are the concrete ways that we can act in solidarity both with movements such as in Egypt and various other places, and with people fighting militarized police and incarceration in the U.S. So maybe just generate some ideas, talk about these things for 10 minutes. You know, with four people around you, you can figure that out, and then we'll just come back together, talk about what people come up with, and then say goodnight. So I'll let you know when your time is soon to end. Thank you. And by the way, I didn't introduce myself. How rude of me. My name is Ali Issa. I'm the National Field Organizer for the War Resisters League, also participating in the Global Justice Working Group of Occupy Wall Street, which puts us together. So, not to break you out of your circles, because actually I was hoping that someone from your groups might just briefly throw out a couple of ideas or reflections that came out of the group and share it with everyone. Is that cool? Are we down? Is there twinkling? Do I see twinkling? Oh, there it is. Okay. So maybe let's just start here for the right, and someone from that group, the closest to me, I mean to say, could just share what they think was the strongest and the most exciting discussion idea they had.
This group?
Yes, that one, please. I'm sorry. And if you could stand, maybe, you know, kind of make me feel like I'm not the only one standing.
We talked about a few things. We said that it was interesting how...
And me, I'm a small audience, very insignificant compared to all of you. So maybe just talk to that.
We talked about a few things, about specifically how this, the past events of 2011 shone a light on how militarized the United States can seem, how militarized the New York police force can seem. And to add to that, a thought that I had was I didn't get a chance to discuss this with the group, but when we talk about stuff like the tear gas, I think it's important to note the rebuttals that the opposition might bring. So one of the rebuttals is they might say that the tear gas was used in a manner that was inappropriate. For example, if you take the canister and you shoot it in the back of the head, that's not how it's supposed to be used. So they might say that even though it's non-lethal, it was used improperly, and that's why you're lethal. So I think when we talk about tear gas, it's important for us to address these issues.
Well, thank you. And I'm sorry, what was your name?
Ali.
Ali, okay. It's a beautiful name. Yeah, so maybe just another group maybe back there. I see it's a largish circle, very powerful one, I'm sensing. Who would like to just speak a few words there? Tease us, if you would. And maybe just introduce yourself as well.
Hi, everybody. I'm Allison. I'm also with the Global Justice Working Group. And we had a large group, so we actually just got a chance to all go around and speak a little bit about actually just answering the question of how policing and militarization affects our different communities. And, I mean, I think it's hard to say. I mean, there's like eight of us, and there's so much more to say. But I think one of the things that came out was that because different communities have different experiences and relations with the police, this leaves us, as we're trying to get together and build a movement and understand one another's experiences, this leaves us with some people are describing an experience and have a relationship with the police that another group just totally doesn't get and totally doesn't have. You know, and often, not surprisingly, it's white people who do not have that experience with the police. So we talked a little bit about that and what that meant, and people had different instances of that. And we also talked about linking our struggles, like also bringing in Iran, also bringing in different ways we can talk about these things together and understand these stories and see them as connected, but we're just beginning.
Well, I guess that's a hopeful point to leave off from. So just maybe a couple more clusters of groups since we soon have to leave. But maybe in the back, who would like to say something inspiring?
No pressure.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I know
Who are you?
I'm sorry. My name's Andy, and I'm with the Labor Outreach Committee of Occupy Wall Street, as well as the Ad Hoc Coalition to Defend the Egyptian Revolution. And I know everyone here is going to be inspired while they're attending the rally this Saturday in support of the Egyptian Revolution, thank you, as well as the teach-ins Monday and Wednesday night at Al-Wan, organized by the Ad Hoc Coalition, and flyers for all those who are in the back.
Great.
So, yeah, and there's actually a few more events to kind of talk about, but maybe any reflections on the left here that was excluded, please share what y'all talked about.
I'm Sherry. I want to suggest before we leave here that maybe we can have a follow-up organizing meeting. There's obviously a convergence between stop and frisk, the Palestine solidarity organizing, the Egypt solidarity organizing, and we have a sort of embarrassment of riches over the next week between the Saturday protests, the Monday and Wednesday teach-ins, God knows how many general assemblies and direct action meetings and what have you. And if we can have a follow-up meeting to actually plan an action at the local tear gas manufacturers, the Point Lookout that was mentioned, I think it's somewhere in the 50s on 6th Avenue. There's also going to be this sort of Israeli apartheid week action. We could plan something credible that will bring together the various forces. I mean, the fact that it's a Thursday night with not a huge amount of building, and we have somewhere between 75 and 85 people or so here tonight is a very good beginning. So maybe we can walk away from here tonight with a follow-up organizing meeting and announce all of these actions and then get massive numbers of people involved in a civil disobedience or whatever it is that is planned at the manufacturers of this agent.
Thank you. Yeah, and so I think that's a really strong idea, and it might be related actually someone to speak.
I do want to speak to add another comment.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Reggie. I'm just curious, what do you, I found what was really interesting was the first, the Egyptian professor, she was talking about
she's right behind you.
They had in the demonstration, they had a support network. So, like, let's say if you were going to get knocked in the head or if you were going to get arrested, you had a support network of, let's say, when you got out of jail, you know, and you had legal support. And a lot of it is a lot of people may not be ready to actually go to the Occupy point, you know, taking that risk. But, you know, like in the old civil rights movement, they had their kids get locked up. But you had, you know, the local grocer and all of the rest of the community doing support stuff. So when they got out, you know that's the thing. Everybody might not be at the point where they're ready, or you know, I mean, you don't have insurance, you get knocked in the head, you know, you got to pay for it. So I mean, I'm just curious, how are you all dealing with that one? And then secondly, for stuff like what the gentleman was saying here about all the international stuff, people outside of, you know, IDs or the usual suspects need to know more of the particulars, like what you all explained about how the companies are connected. What are you all doing to project more into the regular, you know, your concerned regular people who may, you know, who they knew the effects of that?
Yeah, and I wish we could go into those questions. Hopefully these conversations can last, but I believe we have to leave the building in 10 minutes. So I just wanted to share something myself, if I may, call on myself, is that how it goes? And to say that, yeah, I mean, I myself have global connections.
Who are you?
My name is Ali Issa, and I'm in contact with a lot of organizers in Iraq, and I've worked in many organizations, most recently street vendor organizing in New York City, so I often think about how these things connect. And I recently went to a Stop, Stop, and Frisk kind of organizing outreach moment on this past Monday, and I was talking to some of the people there. I just met them, but I mentioned Egypt, and it was amazing how it wasn't just my imagination that showed that they were connected to that place, they were inspired by it, they wanted to connect to it. And one concrete idea that came out was that maybe on the 25th in Tahrir Square, there could be a sign that said Stop, Stop, and Frisk, or Okofu, Stop, and Frisk, right? And that was sort of like really inspiring. It's like a very small action. So Samah emailed her friend, Hassan, who's there, and he's like, interested. So pursuing this is very slow work, and it's actually really challenging, right? Like, how is it that Egyptians, because they're facing the oppression that they are, can actually focus on something like Stop, Stop, and Frisk? How can people that are dealing with Stop, Stop, and Frisk have the time and the capacity to really do work to come out on Saturday or do, you know, even more intentional campaign work? So these are real challenging questions, and meetings are required, like a lot of reflection. And one possibility is the Global Justice Working Group, which this event came out of, being some kind of funnel for those things. So does someone know what the next meeting of that group might be, which maybe could satisfy some of Sherry's suggestions there? Oz?
We regularly have a meeting on Saturday at 3. And there's an outreach email that people can get on. And if there's any change in our schedule, we announce it there. Alternatively, there's a website that's going up. I guess we announce it. Does everybody have the Facebook page for this event?
Yeah, and I mean, one. There's a couple sign-in sheets actually. So one is a.
Send you like the updates or like the links for the email group, so you can find out. And the email group for announcing is public, so even though you don't need to join, you can just go and like, check it, and have the next available meeting for us.
But this weekend, this Saturday, the meeting is moved
for the 21st for the.
But I think there's still going to be one at 4:30. But where? Well, join the list and we'll decide whether we're meeting this Saturday. And if not, the following Saturday. We'll definitely be at 60 Wall at 3 o'clock.
And just because it came up, if you don't have an email, you can leave a phone number.
And that person without an email, I sort of just admire them. but I mean, we really must close. So if there's any sort of closing announcements that are very brief, and I also wanted to thank people, but people have burning things, please.
Well, I guess I just want to say something about the whole militarization question, like how does it affect me and like my community? And I always think back to my father who was drafted into Vietnam, and I'm from a small town in Christian City, Texas. There's 10,000 people. 90% Chicano, and he's like, everyone was drafted, like every minority there, the whole town just got drafted. And so like, I think about that now, where you know, there's no draft, but my friends, and a lot of really close friends who I never thought would go into the military, are there. You know, we're militarizing the world and everything, but also like providing, it seems like the only options that young people have that gives them some sort of security is either you become a cop or you go into the military, right? And it's not like they're doing it for any other reason besides they don't see what else they could do that gives them some sort of line that gives them a future. Let somebody else be able to look at their feet and be like, I know where I'm standing. And so I think that when we look at militarization, we got to look at like what it's doing to like the options young people have and how we have to provide better options and show like other things and other possibilities as we move forward. So that's it.
Thank you. Okay, the final brief statement.
My name is Muhammad Ali. I'm with the American Council for Freedom in Bahrain. We are organizing a one-year anniversary event. It would be February 14th, but that's a Tuesday. It's also Valentine's Day. So February 12th is a Sunday. Hopefully we'll probably be putting on an open mic in the city to sort of build morale for the Bahraini people. We're going to live stream it to Bahrain. Bahraini activists work with us here in America and over in Bahrain. So hopefully that will help. That's the most we can do, we feel, like keep their courage up, keep their morale up. So please look out for an email from, hopefully from Maya, who was kind enough to give me her email, through the Global Justice Working Group. You should be getting that in the next few days. And a tear gas petition for two of these companies that are specifically working or selling tear gas to the government of Bahrain. So thank you.
And Occupy Harlem is standing up right now opposite the Apollo, because Obama evidently ran just for you. And so they'd like to, and we would like to make a comment back to him.
Is he going
We're live streaming.
And so there's information about all these events that were planned on that table back there. So please look into them. And
I'd like to mention something else.
Oh, please, Tamar.
Just that a lot of the stuff that like Occupy like was inspired by stuff that was happening all over the Middle East and the Arab world, and that's something important to keep in mind. But also, you know, this tear gas militarization thing, the anti-globalization movements have been happening worldwide since the beginning. Colonizations and I mean, bring it way back to struggles, you know, from everywhere. And I think that, you know, when we're talking like we were specific and we focused a lot on the Arab world and Syria, but you know, this repercussions of
observation and training bases, you know, here within the United States where we train, you know, for example, the School of the Americas, right? That's where the training facility for all, you know, soldiers and police forces from Latin America converge on, you know, it's like a very, you know, high thing for people to go to. You know, people are proud of going to train in the United States in Fort Benning, in Georgia. And that's another big part of, you know, how money and tax dollars and all these things, you know, as far as strengthening militarization and training in the United States and abroad. And so I just wanted to plug that in for, you know, I spent 2 years in Honduras, and the coup that happened there in 2009, that was also part of Syria as well. And the students are in jail right now. And so the connections between domestic, you know, communities here in the United States that feel that front and all over the world. So just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Tamar.
So,
oh, my God.
No, I'm sorry. I just want to thank you all for coming, and I really hope to see you on Saturday at the Child Rally.
And actually, speaking of